Good morning, everyone. We're going to get started with the Senate Judiciary Committee. Thanks for everyone being here. It's Tuesday the 26th. And, Council, we're going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 2721.
Chair Prezonsky, members of the committee, House Bill 2721 pertains to the spiritual treatment defense which exists in Oregon law for homicide cases. This is a defense which is available when a child or victim is a dependent person and is under care or treatment solely by spiritual means pursuant to the religious beliefs or practices of the child or dependent person with a parent or guardian of that person. If an individual is being treated entirely via prayer and other faith-based means as a substitute for medical treatment under Oregon law, there is an affirmative defense against charges of homicide. House Bill 2721 would eliminate the spiritual defense.
All right, great. Representative Tomei, you're going to start us off?
Yes, thank you.
Thanks.
Chair Prezonsky and members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to come to testify this morning, and thank you for allowing us to be first on the agenda. I am State Representative Carolyn Tomei. I represent Milwaukee and Southeast Portland. This bill, as been stated by Mr. Knott, is a bill dealing with faith healing, and it comes with a unanimous vote both from the Judiciary Committee on the House side and on the floor of the House. I'm sure many of you are familiar with the tragic deaths that have occurred in Clackamas County. In the past 2 years alone, two children have died, and another has been severely disfigured from lack of medical care. Their parents refused to seek medical treatment, but instead relied solely on spiritual treatment for these children when they were ill. These children had readily treatable diseases. They suffered needlessly. Their deaths were avoidable. And this suffering and needless death is not new to Clackamas County. It's been happening for years. When you go to the cemetery in Oregon City and look at the headstones and see these children's names and their ages, it gives one chills, and it's time to say enough. It's time to protect all of our children equally. We should not have separate rules and special treatment for parents with certain religious beliefs. It's time to hold all parents to the same standards, and that's just what House Bill 2721 does. It removes the religious exemptions for serious crimes involving victims younger than 18. It removes language singling out faith-healing parents for lighter sentences in certain crimes for favorable consideration in abuse and neglect cases. There is a long legislative history regarding Oregon and faith healing. The last changes to our laws were in 1999. I've worked with Clackamas County District Attorney John Foote and Assistant District Attorney Greg Horner to develop the language in this bill, and you will hear shortly from them about the details in the bill. And I want to state on the record, these are the heroes in this case. These two gentlemen worked tirelessly for weeks and months and days on these issues. You'll also hear from advocates, child abuse prevention personnel, and medical professionals. I'm supplying you with a copy of Susan Nielsen's recent op-ed piece in the Oregonian, and you have written testimony from the Christian Science Church, and I think there's a gentleman from the Christian Science Church in the hearing room. And also, I gave you a picture of this child. I think, you know, when we hear about death, it's hard for us to visualize what that is like. But when you see the picture of this little girl and her eye, knowing that this could have been treated, that this was preventable, it brings into graphic description what this bill is about. Representative Hunt is here, and Senator Starr are also here to say a few words, and I will close by reading the last line of the testimony that I think you may have received from John Clegg on behalf of the Christian Scientists. Spiritual care should never be practiced at the expense of a child's life. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Representative Dave Hunt from Clackamas County. Representative Tomei has done an excellent job describing the specifics of the bill. Let me just add one additional perspective. I've actually appeared before this committee the last two sessions advocating for bills that you fortunately passed related to strengthening religious free exercise. And I and many of you are strong believers in religious freedom. This, I think, is the perfect example where there are and have got to be legitimate limits on religious freedom. Where you've got situations where parents are using their own religion to justify practices that are detrimental to their children. They are the perpetrators of this neglect, this abuse, and yet they are using currently their religion as a defense for conduct that's detrimental to their own children. That's not religious free exercise. That's not the kind of religious freedom that we should be standing up for. We should be standing up for a balanced standard that does treat all parents equally, that provides a standard of protection for all children, that makes it clear to parents and kids and communities in Clackamas County and throughout our state that this kind of conduct is not acceptable. So I would urge you to treat all parents equally under the law and to really give a voice to these children that right now do not have a voice by passing House Bill 2721.
All right, thank you. Senator?
Yes, thank you very much. For the record, Bruce Starr, I have the privilege of representing Western Washington County. It's interesting that I'm here. Like a lot of you, issues come across your plate that you never expected that you would be dealing with. And I was one of the co-chief sponsors of legislation in 1999 that began us down this process of examining these religious exemptions that have been in our law. The reason that I'm here is I was knocking on doors campaigning in 1998 for a seat in the Oregon House, and I knocked on the door of a man, his name is Bolden Griffith, that said, hey, I want to talk to you about an issue. Are you familiar with the shields in Oregon law as it relates to faith healing? I said, no. I had no idea what he was talking about. And he went on to explain some of the things that were in the law at the time. To me, it didn't sound right. He was a middle-aged man that suffered his entire life because of the family when he was young, how he was raised. So I introduced legislation with former Representative Kathy Lowe. I'm from Hillsboro. She was from Oregon City. The issues that we're faced with primarily are in Oregon City. And so in 1999, with the help former Representative and Senator Kevin Mannix and the chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, Neil Bryan, at the time, were able to come together with a compromise. It was controversial. To be honest with you, from me, as a practicing Christian, there was folks that looked at me like, what are you doing this? Why are you involved in this? Don't you believe that you know, God can heal through prayer? And all those things, I believe, are absolutely true. But we're here today because the work that we did in 1999, though it was important and I think the right step at the right time, we continue to have children die. And I believe that the changes in statutes that are in House Bill 2721 are appropriate. I think it's the right time to finish the job that we started in 1999. You know, we ought to treat children in Oregon the same, regardless of who their parents are, regardless of their parents' religious beliefs. Children need to be protected, and this bill will complete the job. Oregon children will be protected, I believe, in this bill. I appreciate the work of the District Attorney's Office in Clackamas County over the last several years. They worked hard to try to work within the confines that we created for them based on the legislation we passed in 1999. I think they did a good job. But they're here with us asking you and asking this legislature to make the final step. And I appreciate the fact that you're holding a hearing. I'd ask that you move this bill to the Senate floor so that we can get the bill to the governor's desk for a signature, and that all Oregon children will be treated equally under the law. So thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity to testify.
All right, thank you. Questions for anyone on the panel? Senator Bonamici first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, all my colleagues, for bringing this forward. Do you happen to know how other states, this can't be a unique issue in Oregon, do you know if other states are more like the bill that you've brought forward or more like our existing law?
I don't know.
You know, that is a very good question. I do know that other states have historically had some of these same kinds of laws, but over time, I believe, and I think you probably have folks in the audience that testify behind us, a lot of states have removed them just like we are in the process of doing.
All right, Senator Dinkfelder next.
Well, I had a question. Thank you also for bringing this forward, and I'm reading the language right now about dependent person. So this would also apply to not just children, but a dependent adult, or is that not true?
Senator Brzezinski, Senator Dingfeld, that was not our intent. We did look at that, but we did not, as my understanding in reading the bill, it does not include dependent adults, and I think Mr. Knott is nodding. So it does not include dependent adults.
Yeah, I think, Mr. Chair, Senator Dingfelder, it does say, although it uses the term dependent person, it then says a dependent person who is, it references a specific age, although I think the deletion of the word child and substitution of the term dependent is more an LC question, where they're just trying to put things consistent. That was not an intentional change to try and change the application of the law. The intent is still minors.
And a follow-up?
Yes.
Well, and the reason I bring that up, because you could have the situation, I'm sure you know, where you have an older adult or a dependent that needs care and not receiving it. So I guess I was curious.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dinkfelder, there was a Senate bill introduced that did, that I sponsored, that did include dependents, and it was, you know, we kind of decided to not move to that level at this point, but we're focusing on children.
All right, one other question I have is, we looked at the bill, it does not have an emergency clause. Was there a reason that you did not want an emergency clause on this, put it in effect immediately, or do you want to wait until January 1, 2012?
Mr. Chair, I would not object if the emergency clause was added to the bill.
Yeah, I agree.
Other questions, Senator Whitsitt?
I was thinking, Chair, just part of the printed material we have here says Oregon is one of a tiny handful of states, along with Arkansas and West Virginia, to automatically shield faith-healing parents from prosecution for homicide or first-degree manslaughter. Do any of you know whether the laws in other states, apparently 47 other states, have ever been challenged on a constitutional basis?
I don't know that, but Mr. Chair, Senator Whitsitt, I don't know that. I would suggest perhaps that folks maybe that are going to testify behind us that might have the answer to that question.
Okay. Thank you.
The attorney panel is coming.
Yes.
They'll be next. All right. Any other questions? All right. We'll call up the lifelines now.
Thank you.
All right, thank you.
John Foote, Greg Horner, and I'd like Jim Lace, if you'd come up as well with this panel. Doug, are you coming up?
Senator Brzezinski, I'd like to be added to the list.
Why don't you come up now? Jim, hang on. I'll get you in a second. We'll bring up the certified smarts. John, you want to get started?
Sure. Thank you, Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee, and thank you for letting us testify today, giving us that opportunity. For the record, my name is John Foote. I'm the district attorney in Clackamas County. I'll keep my comments brief. I really think Representative Tomei, Representative Hunt, and Senator Starr have done a really good job of framing the issue for you, and we are deeply indebted for their leadership on this. Representative Tomei's office has kept in contact with us steadily over a period of time about how we felt about this. As you know, we've had four cases in the last few years, three in which children died, one in which a child is disfigured. Two of the cases are still pending and we can't talk about them. Two of them are resolved. Greg Horner is here. He's our chief deputy and he handled both of the first two cases, and I think I'd like to give him a chance to talk to you about kind of what those cases were about and answer your questions. But just to give you a little bit of background, we've been working with the church since 2001 to try and prevent deaths, not prosecute people. And that's still our goal. We've reached out to the church in person and in writing to try and find common ground with them. We believe that we are making progress, even though these deaths have happened, and that's tragic, that we believe the church is changing. But we think this is not the time to stop applying the right kind of pressure and the right kind of signals, and we think this legislation is perfectly timed to do that. And most importantly, this is not a bill about religion. This is not a bill against religion. Many of us in this process have faith. It's not important for this process. I think it's important that the Christian Science folks are involved in this and have sent you a letter. We've worked very closely with them. John Clegg is here. We've met with him numerous times to explain our motives and why we're doing what we're doing, that this is not about faith. We think faith is great. We think faith can be powerful, but it does not exclude medical care. That's the point. And this bill will level the playing field so that all parents run by the same rules. It's not going to fix the problem by itself, but it's going to be another step. So we appreciate your support. We very much hope that this bill will pass and become law as quickly as possible. We think the emergency clause is a great idea. So thank you. With that, I'll conclude my comments and let Greg take it.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Greg Horner. I'm the Chief Deputy District Attorney in Clackamas County. I'm here to add my voice to support this bill. I did have the challenge of trying the two cases that have already occurred, and that experience might give you a little insight into what this is all about. The first case involved an 18-month-old little girl who had what's called a cystic hygroma. It was an inflammation of a gland on her neck that was susceptible to common colds, and it ended up expanding and growing to the point where it intruded on her airways. We had expert testimony from the Children's Hospital at Emanuel that indicated that this was a easily treatable disease, although complicated, but certainly not fatal. The second case involved a challenge of a little different sort in that the child was 16 years of age. He had what was unanimously or all agreed upon a bladder obstruction, and that also was easily treatable. And in fact, the testimony was that the experts from the state of Oregon could not find a single example of a child who was suffering from this particular affliction that had actually died from it because they were treatable. Again, it's a little bit more complicated medically, but all the experts, even the defense experts, agreed that this was a treatable affliction and that the child would have lived had he received the appropriate medical treatment. There's a couple of other issues that I'd like to raise because they came up in both cases. And the first one is, and I'm kind of following up on what John was saying, our position from the get-go was that there was not any problem, or we had no objection to the fact that the family and the faith community exercise a number of faith-based treatments, if you want to call it that. We made it very clear to the jurors that we did not have any objection, and it almost seemed ridiculous even to have to say that there was a problem with prayer. We encouraged prayer. We accepted prayer. We endorsed prayer. Our problem was that their medical beliefs were to the exclusion of medical care, and that was the problem. It was the failure to provide medical care when it was obvious, at least from our perspective, that the children needed medical care. So this was not about prayer. It was about the exclusion of medical care. The second point I'd like to make, and it raises one of the issues that I think so much of the community has been interested in, is this apparent conflict between constitutionally protected religious belief and the community's requirement to protect children. And in both cases, the issues of constitutionality of what we were doing in terms of what the state was moving ahead with in terms of the prosecution was thoroughly briefed and argued. And in both cases, the trial judge found that there was nothing unconstitutional about what our approach was to bring these criminal charges. Now, obviously, the trial judge is not the final arbiter of constitutional issues. That will go up to the Court of Appeals, and I fully anticipate that this will be heard by the Oregon Supreme Court. It's possible that it could even go to the U.S. Supreme Court. But it was clear in our research as we went back and looked at what's going on, what are the cases that gave us some guidance in terms of what we were doing. And the U.S. Constitution has been clearly interpreted to protect children. It was not really even a question. Now, the Oregon Constitution, because there was not the lengthy history of cases, was a bit more ambiguous, and there's a little bit more of a question. I'm very confident in that, but as far as the U.S. Constitution, I don't think there's any question that we're on very firm ground. I'm also very confident in our position on the Oregon Constitution, and the trial judge agreed with us. Now, the clarity of the cases is not quite as firm, although there was a case out of, I believe it was Benton County in 1998, in which there was a prosecution of parents for the death of the child, and that was affirmed by the Court of Appeals. So can we say absolutely that it's going to be constitutionally appropriate? No, but I'm very confident in that, and I want to assure you that those issues were thoroughly vetted and thoroughly briefed. The defense put a lot of emphasis on that, as well they should have, as did we, and we spent 3 days arguing pretrial motions, much of it dealing with these pretrial matters about the constitutionality of it. So I'm very confident in that, and it was not an issue that was ignored or slighted or in any way the lack of importance was not ignored. So with that, thank you very much. Appreciate your time and opportunity to testify.
For the record, my name is Doug Harkelrode. I'm the retired Lane County District Attorney, and I represent the Oregon Anti-Crime Alliance. I've submitted written testimony. I shall not read that to you. And I've also submitted to you an editorial from the Eugene Register Guard, a paper where I live, and Senator Prozanski lives, supporting House Bill 2721. We're in favor of it. I'll stop there. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Senator Bonamici first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your testimony. I wanted to ask Mr. Horner, you said you prosecuted the other cases. So obviously there's something in place that allows for prosecution. So can you talk about what the difference would be if this bill passes in terms of prosecuting parents in this situation?
That's the case of the 16-year-old would be exactly the same. There was no constitutional or affirmative defenses. The case in which the child was under the age of 14 years of age, that's where this kicks in. So the child who was 18 months old, that case was handled differently. We presented the case to the grand jury and affirmatively explained to the grand jury what this affirmative defense was. We weren't required to do that, but we wanted the grand jury's assessment of whether they thought that the parents were relying on faith exclusively. So they ended up concluding that the affirmative defense applied, and so we brought what was called manslaughter in the second degree. It's possible that a manslaughter in the first degree could have come out of the first case. So that's one distinction. The second distinction is that we relied on the charge of manslaughter in the second degree, and there is a sentence reduction as part of this bill that prevents what would otherwise be a Measure 11 potential sentence for the conviction for manslaughter in the second degree. So it prevented us from going ahead with manslaughter in the first degree, and it prevented the potential for a Measure 11 sentence on the charge defense of manslaughter in the second degree.
Any other questions, Senator Wissett?
Thank you. Following up on a previous line of questioning, the printed material suggests that there are 47 other states that have adopted laws that do not allow religious beliefs as an affirmative defense. And if that first is that true? And secondly, it just seems incredible that if there's 47 states that have adopted those laws, that none has ever had an appeal of the case.
Well, our research showed that there was not a case in front of the U.S. Supreme Court that directly reflected the facts as we had them. with these faith-based exceptions. So they're for whatever reason, that was not the fact scenario that we could find. There was no case that was directly on point.
May I follow up?
Yes.
Were there any cases within the jurisdiction of the various states?
I'm not sure I understand your question.
Well, there's 40 other states, 47 other states that have laws similar to this. Has there been any determination within those states as to the constitutionality under their constitution or the federal constitution?
There was none that I found, and once we looked at the U.S. Supreme Court and found that there was nothing directly on point, then we focused our attention to the Oregon Constitution, and we looked at anything related to religious exemptions that we could find that might give us some direction on how it would apply here.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you all very much.
Chair, can I just add one? I'm sorry to interrupt, Chair. Members of the committee, I just wanted to add that when we had our initial discussions with Representative Tomei, and I remember this after I finished, we had a specific discussion about whether or not this should be targeted towards minors who were suffering, or more generally, vulnerable people or elderly. And we specifically agreed with her that this would be targeted towards minors. So if there's something in the bill that you're concerned about, I think we can clear that up very easily, because there's no debate among the people who are asking for this bill about what its intentions are. We wanted it to be narrowly focused.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right. The next panel I have is going to include the following. I've got Jim Lace, Rita Swan, and Mickey. Your last name wasn't clear. I'm going to say Loring.
Lansing.
Lansing?
Like Michigan.
Great. It wasn't spelled, or at least I couldn't read the writing that way, but Lansing from Michigan, come on up. If you've handed in written testimony, please do not read it. We'll read it for ourselves, summarize your points, and that would be greatly appreciated. Rita, are you going to start off?
Well, I could. I am president of a national...
I need you to put your name on the record.
Right. Chairman Prozansky and members of Senate Judiciary, I am Rita Swan of Salem, Oregon. I am president of a national membership organization, Children's Health Care is a Legal Duty, which works to stop child abuse and neglect related to religious or cultural beliefs. My husband and I were lifelong Christian Scientists until 1977, when we lost our only son because of following the church's beliefs against medical care. We left the church immediately after his death and have become national advocates for the rights of children to medical care. By this summer, I will have spent half my life on this effort. In December, we relocated temporarily to Salem from Iowa, specifically to work for this bill. And I do have written testimony, and I perhaps should just try to focus on questions that have come up this morning. We do study the laws nationwide, and I can speak to them. There are many states that have religious exemptions from child neglect in the civil code, and the vast majority of those got them during an 8-year period when the federal administration was coercing states to pass these laws in order to get federal funding for child protection programs. And that was from January 1975 to January 1983. The federal government has admitted to me that the Christian Science Church was the only one that asked for this policy. And because of statewide lobbying during the same time when the states were passing these laws in the civil code to get their federal money, there was a push to extend those into the criminal code. So there are several states still today. This policy, this federal policy, was discontinued in 1983 after many visits to Washington by my husband and me. But there are many states that still have religious exemptions, mainly in the civil code, but some do have them in the criminal code, most to misdemeanors. This is definitely not something that states are doing today. There has not been a religious exemption enacted in any state pertaining to medical care of sick children since 1997. And there are many states that have repealed these exemptions over the past two decades because of the harms to children. Oregon is one of only three states in the country that has a religious defense to a homicide charge. It is one of a different set of three states in the country that has a religious defense to a manslaughter charge. It is the only state in the country that has a religious defense to both charges. Oregon and Washington are the only states in the country that have religious defenses to criminal mistreatment. There may be other states that have religious defenses to something that's comparable to criminal mistreatment and is called by a different name. But Oregon and Washington are the only states that have a religious defense to the crime of criminal mistreatment. So our position is that Oregon's laws are very unusual. They are unwise. They send a bad message about Oregon's values. Now, it is true that since 1999, there has been a way to prosecute when parents withhold life-saving medical care from their children. And many of us hoped that the 1999 reforms would be enough to change the followers of Christ's behavior. Bruce Starr had started out with a bill that repealed nine religious exemptions in 1999, and in the compromise, the legislature repealed five of them. This bill repeals the other four. We believe that clear laws do change religiously motivated behavior. Three followers of Christ's children had died in a seven-month period shortly before the 1999 reforms were enacted. After that bill was passed and after the prosecutors went out and talked to the followers, there were no more deaths for several years. In 2003, there was a death, and the Clackamas County prosecutors went out and they talked to the followers. They warned them. They said, we want to prevent deaths. We don't want to spring this on you by a surprise. We could prosecute you for lesser crimes under these 1999 reforms. And again, after 2003, there were no more deaths until 2008. So The evidence suggests that improving these laws, tightening these laws, plus the outreach that the prosecutors do and the media publicity does change their behavior. In terms of our position as parents who have been on the other side of this issue, who have been terrified with a child's illness, a child whom we loved without measure, I feel that this law, that this bill, House Bill 2721, would be a blessing to both parents and children. It would relieve parents of the moral tension of violating laws of the church. It would clarify what society expects of them. We feel that it's really a moral imperative of the legislature to let these parents know where they stand and to send a clear, consistent message across the code that parents have a legal duty to get medical care for their children, regardless of their religious beliefs on the subject. And I could talk for hours.
Thank you for sharing your experiences and your position on the bill. Mickey, why don't you go next?
For the record, my name is Mickey Lansing, and I'm the director of the State Commission on Children and Families. I am also the co-chair of a group called Prevent Child Abuse America, along with Cindy Thompson, who's the director of the Children's Trust Fund of Oregon. And I am here today representing both these groups in support of House Bill 2721. First of all, we want to thank Representative Tomei for her leadership in bringing this forward, and also for Rita Swan, who came before us with this particular issue. In the year 2010, 11,188 victims of child abuse and neglect were reported in Oregon. Of these victims, almost half were our most vulnerable children, those younger than the age of six. We believe that this bill will have an impact on those particular figures. The Children's Trust Fund of Oregon, along with the Department of Human Services, the Commission on Children and Families, the Judicial Department, and Casey Family Programs, which is a private foundation, is working especially in eight counties throughout the state, but we want to make it go statewide to mobilize communities around preventing child abuse neglect. This is one such issue of that. This bill is one more step that we together can take to prevent children from future serious illness and death as a result of inadequate or no medical care. Now, I just am briefly going to share with you a very personal story. And that's that I grew up in Westland, Oregon. I attended Westland High School. The Followers of Christ Church in Oregon City was well known for children not receiving medical care and in some instances dying because that did not occur. In August of this year, I will be attending my 50th class reunion for Westland High School. 50 years is a very long time for this to continue. We urge your support of House Bill 2721.
Thank you. Jim?
Chairman Przanski, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jim Lace. I'm a pediatrician, and I represent the Oregon Medical Association and the Oregon Pediatric Society, and I'm here to testify in favor of House Bill 2721. The only little extra story that I'll add into all this is that when we first passed in 1999, the first go-around on trying to remove some of these exemptions, in Marion County, I had a 15-year-old girl who was being taken care of at home without any medical therapy, and they were relying solely on prayer. We went out, and she was reported, and she actually had a very treatable condition, asthma, but she'd never, ever received treatment. And she really blossomed out for the 3 years that we were able to care for her. But the parents went along with it when the Marion County people went out, and we talked, and we went back and forth and worked it out with them. And they said, fine. They had their objections to it, but they actually went along with the treatment. And I have lost contact with her. She's older than 19, and I have no idea what she's doing. But for those 3 years, it made a big difference. And the parents, when they had the law explained to them, went along with it, too. So it does have an impact. It does work. And we want to get those other four exemptions out of the code. So,
thanks. Great. Thank you. Questions? Thank you all very, very much for coming forward. And Ms. Swan, one thing I am planning on doing is having emergency calls put forward on this. That would mean that it would go into effect sooner than it would have. So with you. With
I'd that, really appreciate that.
You betcha. All right, I got one other person who wants to give testimony, Clark Seeley. Mr. Seeley.
The Oregon Nurses Association asked me to be sure and mention that they were also on in support of the bill, and I have a list on the back.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Seeley. If you could give us your name for the record.
Yes, my name is Reverend Clark Seeley, and I thank you, Chair, that I had the opportunity to speak to you this morning. And I'm speaking against the passage of this law, and I've listened to comments today, and I have not followed it real close as far as the news, but I am concerned about eliminating the possibility of an accused person having a right of defense. And I am a person that does believe in God. I do believe in the power of God to heal. I do go to doctors. One evidence of that is I wear these glasses, so I have no objection to going to doctors. And just recently I went to a physician on some issues relating to my skin. But even though I do go to doctors, I maintain a certain level of skepticism about medical science. And one reason why I do that is because I watch TV and I often hear the commercials on prescription drugs and the complications and things that can happen from them or from the misapplication from medical doctors. And even though I have this skepticism about medical science, I do not hold the same skepticism about the Lord. And I do know that He does heal, and I've had personal experiences of that. And I'm not here to defend the Church of Christ. I don't really know much about it, and I wouldn't practice as they do, but I would like to say that I'm concerned about eliminating this defense, because there's always a possibility that an aggressive DA who perhaps has a personal agenda could take things and use things on technicalities. And if you think this doesn't happen, you could consider a very notorious case, not related necessarily to medical practice, but it's about the Duke LaCrosse rape case, where the district attorney actually, I think, was removed from office because he was injecting too much of his personal issues. And so I'm also concerned because when I've read some of the stories about this, that on in reading the blogs, I heard comments from read comments from different people that oftentimes those who were against the defense of faith and healing often made disparaging remarks about Christianity, about God and such, and I'm concerned about that coming into play in terms of how people would view this problem. And maybe most importantly, the reality is, at least from this last case, the parents, I believe, were successfully prosecuted. And so there is already in place the ability to prosecute if the district attorneys can present a credible case and not just rubber stamp things. So I would appreciate it if you would just allow this bill to be tabled and not proceed with it. Thank you.
Thank you. Before you leave, questions? Mr. Seeley, thank you very much for coming forward today. I didn't have anyone else that was scheduled to give testimony, at least signed up on a registration. I just want to make certain before I close the public hearing, if there's anyone else, not seeing anyone, we're closing the public hearing on 2721. Representative Hicks, give me a ballpark of how much time you need so I know.
Senator, I'd say 7 minutes.
All right, you're ready to go?
Yes.
All right, we're opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 3142. Oh, excuse me, House Bill 3142. I'll learn. Aaron?
Thank you, Chair Pozanski, members of the committee. House Bill 3142 would add a youth correction facility staff within the definition of staff member for the purposes of assault in the third degree and aggravated harassment. Under present law, you assault other individuals under that section, corrections officers, departments of correction, etc. That would be an assault in the third degree if you propel dangerous substances like blood or semen or feces. That would be an aggravated harassment, but presently neither of those would apply for youth correction facility staff. It would be merely an assault in fourth degree, a Class A misdemeanor, or a misdemeanor harassment.
All right, and Wally, while you're getting that set up, I have two other people that want to give testimony, Tori Lynn and David Koch. Why don't y'all come on up, and we'll just have everyone up here at the panel.
should be.
Okay, we're good. Good morning.
Good morning,
Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I am Representative Wally Hicks. I represent House District 3, Josephine County. House Bill 3142 was a bill that I have proposed based on a case that I actually prosecuted in late 2009. The bill passed off the House floor. There is no known opposition at this time. It's largely a technical fix, but there is some appropriate explaining and a video to show the committee members. I think it's function F8, fam. Let's try that. The incident which led to this proposed statutory adjustment. And, there it is. Good. So, late 2009, the exact date and month escaped me at the time, but a youth inmate, a 16-year-old offender who was serving a short sentence on a burglary 2 jurisdictional finding in the Josephine County Detention Facility, and again I say county detention facility because that definition becomes operable here later on, was being tended by a paid professional staff member. She was technically a teacher, but part of her duties were to watch the inmates as they were in their recreation facility. And the youth, as they're known in the juvenile system, decided to make an escape attempt. This was all captured on film, and shortly I'll be able to show the committee what happened. But essentially his motive was he had just been told, incidentally by the judge, that he was going to serve one more night on his sentence and then be released. And youth don't always make logical decisions, and so it seems he wanted to get an escape under his belt before he got released. In the process of the escape, he did commit the following additional crime.
Just want to note, do we need a disclaimer here? Has this been rated, like is it a G, G13, this R? What are we going to be?
I would rate this.
Members here that want to make sure everyone's MA. Ready.
This is scenes of violence.
All right.
So probably PG-13.
Because I'm a very sensitive person. Yes.
It could be showed after 10 p.m. Sure, on prime
sure
time
on
or any time on HBO. All right. So I've got this thing. There's no sound.
So
the figure in blue is the victim, is the prospective victim. And this is the recreation portion of the Josephine County Detention Facility.
So it looks like there are three youth that are inside with her.
There are three youth dressed in orange jumpsuits. Now the youth in the sweatshirt comes over and does a high kick to the back of the victim's, or the victim's back, the upper back area, and then makes a break for it and tries to scale the fence. In the adrenaline of the moment, she is able to get up, but she was, it turns out, injured.
Looks like the other two youth wisely are moving away from the incident.
They are, Mr. Chair. And soon they'll be adhering to detention protocol. They're on the floor. The other staff members are coming in to assist. But because of the staffing levels, it was just that one staff member in there at the time.
The offender looks like he also went to the ground voluntarily.
Sort of. He had to be pulled off the fence first. So
by the victim?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Yes, the victim. And we can even rewind to the...
No, that's fine.
So that's what happened. A couple of crimes committed there, certainly escape being one, but assault was another crime that was committed. I charged the crime as felony assault under ORS 163.165. It's a statute that enumerates certain classes of victims and has very carefully, thank you, Pam, structured way of defining who falls within the class. Taxi drivers, for example, are among the classified persons, as are persons who work at youth correction facilities or OIA facilities, persons who work at OIA facilities, and indeed volunteers who work at county detention facilities. I've submitted to the committee the transcript of the ruling of Judge Michael Newman, who did find jurisdiction in this case, but in the course of doing so, he very carefully parsed ORS 163.165 and ruled that he could not find the youth guilty of assault 3 because, oddly enough, the statute covered volunteers of county detention facilities but not paid staff members. The court did speculate that this was a legislative oversight, but then he does, and I'm not going to read the whole thing, of course, but I'm just going to, because I think he states it very succinctly. Judge says, but I'm not permitted to do what the legislature didn't do, as the appellate courts have made clear over and over, so I'm not going to stretch the statute to say something that may have been intended by the legislature but wasn't stated. So the bill seeks to state what I think was intended and is not yet stated.
All right. Representative, I'm not sure your schedule. Do you want to wait for questions and have the other two speak, or do you need to leave?
Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to wait.
Either you want to. Okay. Who wants to go next?
Chair Przanski, members of the committee. My name is Tori Lynn. I'm the director for the Linn County Juvenile Department in Albany, Oregon. I'm also here representing the Oregon Juvenile Directors Association. In Linn County, we have a population of just over 12,000 youth between the ages of 10 and 17, 116,000 total youth under 18. Linn County operates a 20-bed juvenile detention center serving both Linn and Benton counties. Youth come to detention because of criteria that's set forth in ORS 419C145. They've committed a felony, one of three misdemeanors, willfully failed to appear for court, or a fugitive from another jurisdiction, or violated probation or parole agreements. In Linn County, we placed 288 unduplicated youth in our detention center. That's about 2% of our population for the 10 to 17. 71 of those youth, unduplicated youth, were in the care and custody of the Oregon Youth Authority. That's about 25% of the population of that unduplicated youth. If we add Benton County's totals, for our total facility population, there's about 20% of our population at any given time that are Oregon Youth Authority youth in our detention center. Linn-Benton Detention Center, for those youth that we held, just under 5,000 days of care for the 288 youth that were held. Oregon Youth Authority youth accounted for just over 1,500 days of care. So really the point being that we're serving both of those populations, that they're pretty equivalent. The youth that are in the Oregon Youth Authority care, either on parole or on probation, come into our detention centers, and so the population is really the same. What we know about adolescent brain development is that juveniles have poor impulse control and their critical thinking skills have not been fully developed yet. Combine the fact that many of the youth that come into our facilities are under the influence of drugs or alcohol, certainly makes for a very unpredictable situation. It's common that police agencies have to take youth to be medically cleared at hospitals because of their drug and alcohol use before they come into our detention centers. Most youth going into OYA, youth correctional facilities, have been either in detention or county jails for some substantial periods of time. So when you look at the stability factors of, or the predictability of behavior, the youth in correctional facilities actually would be much more predictable because of those other influences and the stabilization that has happened either at detention centers or in county jails. Most commonly, detention staff do not know what they're getting until that youth is standing in front of them, until they're able to do that intake and make judgments about whether the youth is under the influence or other factors that may serve that unpredictability piece. I would urge you to support House Bill 3142, adding juvenile detention workers to the definition of youth correctional facility staff. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today.
All right, thank you. David?
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, David Cook. I'm the Director of Juvenile Services in Multnomah County. I've submitted some written testimony on behalf of the Oregon Juvenile Department Directors Association and won't reiterate everything Tori said. In Multnomah County, we have a 191-bed detention facility that serves Clackamas, Washington, and Multnomah counties. And essentially, in looking at this bill and the populations we serve, this bill would simply correct an oversight, apparently, in statute. And the kids and youth that we manage in juvenile detention facilities across the state are no different than the youth that are managed in youth correctional facilities. And since many of us in juvenile who operate juvenile detention facilities also supervise Measure 11, youth charged with Measure 11 offenses, these are some of the same kids that are also managed in local jails. If they happen to be 16 and 17 and charged with Measure 11 and they're not housed in juvenile detention. So essentially this is an equity issue. I think you're aware of that, and certainly we appreciate Representative Hicks bringing forward this bill and just encourage your support of it. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Gentlemen, thank you very much for coming forward. I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 30, House Bill 3142, and we're going to go ahead and open up a public hearing on House Bill 2698.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, House Bill 2698 pertains to the setting aside of a record of an arrest under current law and any time after the lapse of 1 year from the date of an arrest, which doesn't result in the issuance of an accusatory instrument or any time after an acquittal or dismissal of a charge that is issued. A person can apply to the court for an entry of an order to set aside record of the arrest. However, this doesn't apply, and this provision is not presently available, if there's a record of an arrest excluding for motor vehicle violations within the three-year period prior. So you can go to trial or and be acquitted or be arrested and then have that used as a basis to not set aside record of a subsequent arrest or acquittal. House Bill 2698 would amend this to just to say that an arrest that has been set aside cannot be used to disqualify you in the future from this provision.
All right. Jules?
Thank you, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jules Bailey. I represent House District 42. I appreciate you hearing this bill today. This bill is, I think, best characterized as a step forward on the principle of innocent until proven guilty. And I want to be clear that this bill, House Bill 2698, focuses on setting aside arrests without conviction. You recently heard, just prior to this bill, testimony from my good friend and colleague, Representative Wally Hicks. We are sometimes confused for each other in the halls of this Capitol. And I would certainly not want him to not be able to hide or set aside an arrest for a crime that perhaps I might have committed. So this is really about that principle of innocent until proven guilty. And the issue here, and the reason we're bringing it forward in this session, is that this is really, for all intents and purposes, a jobs bill. When you have a person who applies for employment, there is a section on the form often asked, have you ever been arrested? And unless that arrest has been set aside, the applicant is obligated to check the yes box on that form. And that can often lead to disqualification from employment. Imagine having to check that form if you were wrongly accused, if you were found innocent for any number of different reasons. You would want to be able to set aside that arrest and be able to say with to an employer that you had not been arrested and be equally eligible for that employment with other applicants. My friend Mr. Blumenthal can go into some of the details a little bit more, but this does not apply. This only applies to Class C felonies, does not apply to more serious crimes, and it also ensures that the records are still available to law enforcement and courts that are looking into a particular issue, a particular case. And with that, I'd be happy to turn it over and take any questions.
All right.
Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee, Eric Blumenthal. I'm a constituent of Jules. Basically, just what this bill does is it just makes it so that when you file a motion to expunge an arrest, and by arrest I mean an arrest that hasn't resulted in a conviction in which either the charges were dismissed or that over a year has passed between the arrest and then the non-issuance of a charging instrument, that when the person files a motion to basically to seal an arrest, it doesn't actually make it go away, but it just seals it, that when the court considers it, the court isn't going to deny a person or at least render a person ineligible because they've previously had another arrest which also didn't result in a conviction expunged.
All right. Great. Questions? I do have one myself. Jules, you said that this would be for Class C felonies. I'm assuming that would be the high end, meaning misdemeanors would also be covered, or just Class C felonies?
Chair Brzezinski, that's my understanding, is that that's the high end.
Okay.
Right. Actually, I believe that the Class C felonies, when we first proposed the bill, we proposed it to lower the amount of time needed by which, you know, needed to wait for a bill for a person to become eligible to get a conviction expunged. After the House Judiciary hearing, we limited it to just arrests that didn't result in convictions, and it actually applies to any arrest except for arrest for DUII that doesn't result. That goes through diversion, because right. Diversion is sort of a special circumstance. So it does apply to any arrest, but the key thing is that this is distinct from convictions. So the convictions expungement rules are not being affected at all. This is only for arrests where nothing comes of it, and so the person's entitled to live their life under their continued presumption of innocence.
All right, so just for the record, what I just heard, correct me if I'm wrong, any arrest could be expunged or set aside with the exception of a DUII because of the diversion issues,
yeah.
Making sure you have the ticker in the counter. Is that correct?
Correct. That's the way the law presently stands now, too.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, it's good I have legal counsel.
Right. Well, that's why we're going through this. All right. Any other questions? Gentlemen, thank you very much. We'll go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 2698.
Thank you.
And we have two other bills. I'm going to go ahead and open up the next one that we have people here, and we're going to put a call into Rep. Gelsler, get her to come up for the next bill. But I'm going to go ahead and bring in 2702. Public hearing is open.
Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee, House Bill 2702 pertains to individuals who are participating in a DUII diversion program while simultaneously being engaged in service in one of America's armed forces. Presently, this is sort of an issue if somebody picks up a DUII and goes into diversion, but they're on active duty and they're deployed. There aren't really provisions in the law to allow for extensions. House Bill 2702 would allow a court to it would allow a person who is in the armed services, upon demonstrating that they're in the armed services and that it is in fact interfering with their ability to complete a diversion program, it would allow them to request a good cause extension. Normally, these good cause extensions are very structured within diversion, but this would give the judge discretion to essentially craft an extension to work with that person's term of service. It would also allow them to appear at show cause hearings telephonically if they could not appear personally, and it would allow them to find comparable programs outside of the jurisdiction of the diversion court in which to complete their treatment.
Jess, why don't you come on up? And Pam, if you could. Wonderful, thank you.
Senator Brzezinski, that was one of the sign-up sheets I didn't sign in because I was late today.
Are we talking about on this one
yes,
here?
Yes, this bill here.
Come on up.
Thank you.
Jess, why don't you go ahead and get us started?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Jesse Barton. I'm an attorney in private practice here in Salem. I'm a member of the State Bar's Military Assistance Panel. I'm on the board of directors of the Returning Veterans Project. Your committee counsel gave a good summary of the bill. I just want to make one thing, just sort of a real clarification point, and that's that with the dash two amendments to the bill from the House side, which are now in the engrossed version of the bill, a service member is going to have to do in order to get this kind of stay of his diversion program is he's going to have to establish that his active duty assignment, wherever it is, there's not going to be a comparable DUI diversion program there. He might be able to do that before he goes on to active duty. He might be able to contact folks at wherever he's going to. Say, I'm going to use the example, Fort Gordon, Georgia. He might be able to talk to folks there and establish that, yes, there is a diversion program here you could take. It's comparable. He's going to have to establish that, too, to the folks, to the satisfaction of the folks back in Oregon. But if he could show that there's a diversion program in and around Fort Gordon, Georgia, then that's where he'll do his DUI diversion. He'll do it there while he's on active duty. But if he cannot establish that there's an active duty, or excuse me, a comparable diversion program to wherever it is he's going, let's say he's going to be at a forward operating base in somewhere in Afghanistan, there's not going to be any kind of diversion program. He's not going to have running water there. So he would then be able to get the stay. That's the way that works.
Right. Fair enough. I mean, that's pretty much what we've seen. Even individuals that are actually on active duty that can actually have their diversion program wherever they're stationed, and so that sounds like a great fix.
Right.
Doug?
For the record, Doug Harkle-Road. I'm the retired district attorney from Lane County, and I currently represent the Oregon Anti-Crime Alliance, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. I helped Mr. Barton work this bill and put the amendments together, and the Oregon Anti-Crime Alliance supports that this is a good idea. It'll help the military, and I'm all for doing that. Thank you.
All right, great. Thank you. Questions, Senator Cruz?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just curious, support the bill, obviously, but what sort of hoops are people going to have to jump through to prove that a diversion program in North Carolina is comparable? Is it relatively straightforward?
It's basically through the program that they're going through the court that's actually they're under.
Right.
They have someone they refer the person to go through kind of like the catch-all for all of the arrangements. They will make the contact, so it would be the certified smart people in Oregon speaking to the people
in the program.
Whatever state it is in
that's
to
okay.
make certain they are compatible.
Okay. So the service person isn't going to have to do a whole lot of monkeying around. The system will make the determination. Then all he or she has to do is show up and take the program.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Cruz, there's going to be some work involved for the service member. He's going to have to get out there. He's going to have to get out there, get some kind of a description of the program, show it to the folks in Oregon, and you know it should work out pretty well. But there's going to be some work to be done. It's not going to be done for him. It's going to have some personal responsibility involved in the whole thing.
Yeah, the experience I've had in these, they actually have the program wherever they want to go will contact the Oregon connection, and they'll find out what are the requirements and determine whether that program actually meets those requirements. So it's basically the portion for the service person will be where are you going to be located, make contact there, see if they actually have a program, and get the two connected to talk to make certain it qualifies.
Okay. The reason for the question is Oregon is famous for not being overly cooperative on reciprocity on a whole lot of other issues, and hopefully this is not one of those.
I have not had that experience.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions? Gentlemen, thank you very much. Is there anyone else who wants to give testimony today on 2702? Not seeing anyone, we'll go ahead and close the public hearing. We're going to go ahead and open up our last public hearing scheduled for today on House Bill 2652.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, House Bill 2652 pertains to the disqualification of individuals from serving as a fiduciary, health care representative, attorney, or surrogate if a court finds unfit for parenting or determines that it would be unsafe for a dependent or protected person, principal, child, youth, or youth offender to return to that person's home. It allows for that person, while no longer incapacitated, to, on their own, petition the court to allow for reinstatement of those privileges. So basically, this says that if you, you're found unfit to be a parent, you can't then go and immediately become a fiduciary or attorney in fact for the person against whom you are protected.
All right, we're ready to go. Great segue. Representative Gelser and Gilmeyer, why don't you both come up, please. Did you not want to be on this list?
No.
All right, I'll cross you off the list.
That was
nice. All right, we're down to one.
Cuts the list in half.
Yeah.
Chair Pruszanski, members of the committee, thank you for having me here today on House Bill 2652. House Bill 2652 is intended to correct a miscommunication, really, between the child welfare system and the adult court system. Sometimes children with developmental disabilities, intellectual disabilities, or profound physical disabilities may be removed from their homes due to abuse or neglect. And when they enter into the foster care system, they may not find permanency through an adoptive home. Their permanency plan may be an alternative other than adoption, which would be long-term foster care. But when they turn 18 and age out of the foster care system and continue to need someone to act as their health care representative, their educational surrogate, a person to administer their financial matters, there is nothing currently in the law that prevents those same individuals that they have been taken from to protect their safety for coming back in and becoming their representative in these other areas. The most troubling situation here is the fiduciary representative, where someone can come back in and then take advantage of those Social Security disability checks. So what this bill does is simply clarifies that an individual that has been removed due to abuse and neglect may not have as their health care representative or fiduciary that same person after they turn 18, unless that individual on their own as a competent person goes and says that they want this person to do it. The reason that we made that amendment to the bill was to clarify for an individual that may reunite with a parent that they have been removed from earlier in their life who has the competence to choose that they want that person to be their health care representative and an advance directive. This bill did not intend to get in the way of those relationships. It is really to protect the very most vulnerable from further physical and financial abuse.
All right, great. Thank you. Questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
We're going. Is there anyone else who want to give testimony on 2652? Not seeing anyone. We'll close the public hearing on 2652. And tomorrow, I think we're set to start at 8:30. Wednesday. We are starting at 8:30. And I think on Thursday we may be starting a little bit earlier. There's a meeting that I found out I'm in at 7, and I think we're going to schedule starting at 8, but we may start at 8:15 just because of the transition.
Tomorrow's 8:40. Yeah, Mr. Chair, I received an agenda that's at 8:45.
Oh, that's correct. Tomorrow is 8:45. There is something else that caught me. So tomorrow, Wednesday, the 27th, we will be here at 8:45. With that, we're adjourned.